Hello, everyone. My name is Angelique Jackson, film and media reporter with Variety, and thank you so much for joining us for this morning's conversation about the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel and the adaptation by one Mr. Barry Jenkins, The Underground Railroad, which will premiere on Amazon Prime Video on May 14th. Joining me for this conversation, of course, is our creator and director. You see him there, Mr. Barry Jenkins.
Hi.
Next up, we have Tuso Mbedu, our star. She plays Cora.
Hello.
Next, we have Joel Edgerton, who plays Ridgeway. Then we have Aaron Pierre, who plays Caesar. Hello. Next, we have William Jackson Harper, who plays Royal. And last, but certainly not least, we have Sheila Adam, who plays Mabel. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Good morning. Hello.
Good morning. Well, thank you so much for joining us virtually to dissect and discuss this series. It is incredible, really. It's truly an incredible feat that this book was brought to the screen. And so really, for that reason, I will start with Mr. Jenkins here. You've talked about how, you know, this was a story and is a story for our ancestors. It's a show and tribute to them. What did you hope to capture in telling Cora's story on screen?
I think the biggest thing for me, one, I love the book. I thought Coulson had created a really great opportunity to, I don't know, maybe even recontextualize the story of our ancestors. By focusing on this young woman, Cora, you watch the show and, you know, there's this version where maybe without seeing it, you assume for 10 episodes, Cora is trying to vanquish the condition of American slavery. But what she's really after is she's trying to reconcile this sense of abandonment she feels towards her mother. And I thought that was a really interesting way to come at a story like this, to present this very, I think, truthful, but also just massive in scope and scale journey that was ultimately about parenting and about a daughter's relationship to her mother and learning without having direct biography of what her mother went through, understanding that journey because of the journey she goes through herself. And so, yeah, I thought it was an opportunity to test my skills on a canvas like that.
And of course, this is your most significant foray into television as well. Why was it so important to tell this story in this format versus a film?
I think the biggest thing was three things. I think when you go into a movie theater, it's a very captive experience. So you kind of have to surrender yourself. You're in the middle of a 30-seat aisle. You turn your phone off. I think some of the images in the show, knowing the subject matter, I wanted the audience to have the opportunity. You can pause, you can play, you can skip, you can choose whom you want to watch this with or whether you want to watch it alone. So that was part of the reason why I felt like it had to be a series. I think secondly, some of these images are rooted in fact or in truth of the actual lived experience. I think in a shorter time frame, those images can be so loud that they overwhelm what I call the softer images. And so it felt like giving Cora the full space to encounter all these beautiful people on this the Zoom with me, giving her the full space to do that over the course of 10 episodes versus one feature, it felt like the best way to capture the full spectrum of her experience.
Well, speaking of all these beautiful people that are on this Zoom with us, let's start there. Let's talk about building this incredible ensemble cast. And I would like to start with Cora herself, with Tuso. How did you find her, and how did you realize that she was the perfect Cora for this story?
Is that to me or to Tuso?
That's to you first. I'm going to ask you first. How did you first?
I was like, what is Joel? I think you found me. you know, I have an open door policy when it comes to casting these projects. If you can show me that you are the character, then the part is yours. And Tuso's tape came through, I recognized immediately that she had this ability, knowing that this character was going to start in a place where she didn't have full possession of herself and would go through the process of gaining possession of herself. In the early part, she has to be able to emote with her face, with her shoulders, with her posture, and Tuso very clearly was capable of that. I also knew that as she goes through the ebbs and flows of this journey, there will be moments where the character will seem incredibly young, and then other moments where the character was seen incredibly not young. And Tuso has this ability to look both 16 and 66, depending on the situation she's in. And yeah, I think from the moment we first met, from the very first tape, it was very clear that she was the one.
Oh, no.
What do you remember about that moment of first meeting, or actually really even further back, of making that tape, learning this project was happening and deciding you wanted to audition?
You know, well, when I heard of the audition or the brief for the audition, it was something exciting for me because it would have been like my very first big international audition. But I didn't think much of it because I really did not rate myself that much. I didn't think anything would come from it. I did the tape, you know, put it on the table and sort of just forgot about it until 2019, where I was invited to do a work session with Francine Maisler, who was the casting director for the show. And I was like, I can't do any worse than I did last year, so let me just, you know, put my best foot forward. We played around with the material. She stretched me. You know, she did things that I didn't know. She pushed me to places where I didn't know I could go. And I was just like, I'm happy I met her. I'm in her archives in case something else comes along, you know. And then that evening I got a call and they told me it was a callback and that Barry wanted to meet me the next evening. And I was like, oh, okay. And then when I met Barry, I found out that it was actually based on a book, which then after having met Barry, I went to read the book and I was like, oh snap, this is bigger than anything I ever could have thought or imagined. It's a very important story and I would love to tell the story. I don't know if I have it in me to tell the story, but you know what, I'll do what I need to do and the rest is in God's hands, the rest is in Barry's hands. And yeah, we had the test shoot. Barry was amazing. Oh, Barry worked me! He worked me so hard, my contact lens flipped in on itself. I said,
you know, it's funny, I forgot about that. I do remember that. I do remember that. Yeah, and because it was important, this was while Bill Street was in release, and so I brought Stephon James in for the callback with Tuso. So between myself and Francine and Stephon, yes, we did put you through your paces.
You did. But it was amazing. And through that and the test shoot, I was like, you know what? I've been stretched. I've been challenged. I did my best. And even if I don't get the role, I know that I've grown just from the audition process. Yeah.
Now, did anybody else get their contact flipped out inside out during their test process?
Yeah.
It was a hard shoot, but...
Funny when Tuso was saying that, the only times my contact lenses flip are in moments of high intensity, so I could relate.
Well, Joel, I will go to you next since you chimed in. Portraying Ridgeway, the primary protagonist of this story, how did you get involved? I feel like I understand that what Barry said earlier about her finding him may have been more of the case of you being a part of this. Did you chase him down to work together?
Yeah, look, you know, I did insinuate myself into the process. Is that probably the right phrase? I'd heard about it. I'd met Barry in various sort of events. And look, I think the most poignant, I guess, is that I love the things that Barry had already made, and I had learned from other people that they really enjoyed the process of working with him. And when I found out about this, I definitely kind of tapped him on the shoulder and was like, I'm really interested to work with you, and can we talk about this? And reading the book, the one thing that made me nervous that I might not be appropriate. I think in the book, Ridgway is described as being giant, and I'm not a giant. I mean, I'm not tiny, but I'm not certainly not a giant. Yeah, I very much chased it down, and actually, and you know, when I was younger, I used to have that energy where I would learn about projects and try and knock down doors. And not that I've become complacent in my middle age, but it reminded me of that leaning on my toes enthusiasm was chasing Barry down. And I'm really happy that I had the courage to put my ego aside and really try and grab him and say, hey, I'd really like to be a part of this if it feels appropriate. And I'm really glad that I did.
Did you know that it was important? Aaron, Will, you both, as Caesar and Royal, portray these bright spots in Cora's very difficult journey, the love that she has, that she's kind of missing in filling those roles. What was it about these two men and these kind of different inflection points of joy for Cora that made you want to be a part of this? Aaron, I'll start with you.
I think for me, what I imagine that Caesar represented in Cora's journey was the idea of possibility, the idea of transcendence from the physical reality. And that really drew me to the character and the energy that is within him throughout the series. I'm a really firm believer in terms of my understanding of the novel and the series, that Cora already had that flame and that desire to obtain true freedom and true liberty already. So I consider Caesar just one of many catalysts. And if anything, he only contributed to that flame that was already burning inside of her to go and pursue what she ultimately always wanted.
And William, for you, with Royal.
Yeah, I think the thing that I found most attractive in playing this role was, I feel like Royals is very much a symbol of hope, and sort of like he's a man ahead of his time in a lot of ways. And you know, there's a way in which he just moves through the world. He's not, and like I think that, you know, all of our characters stand to learn a lot from Cora, but I think that in a lot of ways, just the paradigm shift of, you know, Indiana and being a freeborn black man is just the way he operates is slightly different. And so it's not about like, hey, you know, let me show you these new things. It's just like, this is the way this is. Join in if you feel like it. And it's, you know, like that's a lot of fun to try to play with. And I think also the other thing is there's a gentleness with us that I'd like to lean into. And it's like a thing that, like, I'm not, that's not me. I'm like a very unsentimental, ungentle dude. And so like, it's fun to try to do that and really live that. And, you know, honestly, with Tuso, it's easy just because it's, you know, it's Tuso. But like, you know, it's that's something that was a really big draw for me and a lot of fun to play with.
And then Sheila, Mabel is kind of like the specter over the story for a lot of Cora's journey. We get to see bits and pieces of who she is until we finally get the full picture. What was it about this mother and the way that she, you know, forms a lot of her daughter's story without being directly in it that made you want to be a part of this?
Mabel, for me, she kind of encapsulates the struggle of trying to create a life in what is absolutely a completely unnatural and inhumane circumstance and environment, but still doing everything she can to to push through for herself, for her daughter, for the community that she's trying to form and trying to keep together there. You know, she's a midwife. She's bringing life into this world and into this circumstance. And that's a double-edged sword in itself, because you know that you are bringing a baby into this world. But at the same time, you feel a responsibility to try and do that as humanely and as safely as possible. So I think for Mabel, there was just so much on her shoulders, so much responsibility, so much duty, to so many different people, whether they asked for it or not. I think she really felt that she wore that on her shoulders, and, you know, but she was a human being who was also herself living in that situation and victim of that situation as well. So yeah, I feel like she really represents the schism and the tension that so many people must have been experiencing during that time.
And Barry, with this series, you are presenting a truly unflinching narrative about slavery and the antebellum era, but you found a way to make this and collaborate with your actors in a way to do this safely, emotionally safely. How important was that to the process of bringing this to the screen, knowing how real you needed to portray it, but also to be able to make sure that yourself and everyone else was okay?
Yeah, it was, it was as important as getting the scene right or, you know, the logistics. I mean, it was probably even more important because, it's not worth, you know, it's not worth creating these things if it's going to destroy us in the process. And so, we had a therapist, or we referred to as a guidance counselor on set at all times, Ms. Kim White. And I think we also had each other. I think for me, it was about trying to always understand what the moral and ethical sort of line of what we were doing, where that line was, and not even in an attempt to walk right up to the line, but to always be aware of what it was and what we were trying to communicate with the work we were doing on any given day. And I think everyone knew they had the freedom, you know, to decide for themselves, you know, at what point they felt like they were too close to the line, or at what point something I was asking them to do, or even as performers that they were asking of themselves and the character, at what point is this not worth it? Because I can't be destroyed in the process of replicating such destructive event or happening. And it was crucial, but it's something that, you know, I don't think any of us can take sole credit for. I think we kind of lifted each other up in this really beautiful way. And I mean, from the top of the crew list all the way down to the bottom. And I think everybody knew if you needed an out was there. You know, I remember, I've told the story a few times, but Benjamin Walker, who plays Terrence Randall, the day we filmed what I think is the hardest scene in the show, you know, comes in the first episode, he was sitting at the table, and he's fully in costume, 200 degrees, we're about to go. He takes out his phone, he goes, hey, because he's born and raised in Georgia, so he's like one of the few Georgians in the cast, but he lives in London. He's like, you know, I think it's about 9 o'clock in London, you mind if I just call to tuck my kids in? And the PA standing next to him was like, no, sorry, Mr. Walker, but we're about to go. And I walked over, I said, bruh, let that man go call his kids and tuck them in, because once he's done with that, he's got to come over here and do these things. And I knew it was to reaffirm to himself, I am this person, but now it's my duty to become this person. He just had to remind himself. And I think everybody had the freedom to do that. And I think that's how we kind of got through it.
That actually leads us to our first question from Noel Manning from Meet Me at the Movies. This is to any and all of the cast. What did you learn about each other during the shoot, about acting and collaboration in particular? Who would like to take it? Tuso, I saw you smile, so I'm going to send that one to you first, since you collaborated with most of this group in particular.
I think alluding to the whole being safe and trusting the people around you thing, I appreciated that there was no incorrect offer when it came to working with the cast. It was like, okay, we're here to play. We know the objective. We know the goal. there are certain like boundaries or whatever rules to the game, but we can play this game in any way, and not I don't have to prejudge myself because I know that I'm trusting the person that I'm working with. I think that was my biggest takeaway. It was fun, like you having conversations on set, off set. It really worked with the group dynamic, with the individual, you know, relationships. And you know that you knew that you could take each other's hands and take the leap and go further than you could have imagined. Yeah.
Can I add something to, I'd like to use this opportunity to bring into this room someone who's not here, who is Chase W. Dillon, who is one of the centerpieces of this show that I got to work with every single day that I was on set. And now, and what I learned, I guess, about performing, and I'm always looking to learn something, and I learn it quite often from young people. And young people's sort of, and it's not all young people, but this particular young man and his imagination, his willingness to just lean into everything that Mr. Barry wanted, and without too much, you know, analyzing, too much pre-thought, and just giving himself into it. And I always find pleasure in learning and being reminded of that headspace. And Chase, I continuously salute.
What was one thing that you picked up from him during this process?
Sass. Well, you know, like I tell you what, I'm constantly impressed when people remind me not to underestimate. And I think there's just a general setting in our heads that we see a child and we go, I have status and I underestimate. And when you realize that a child is possessed of their own imagination that may be more abundant than your own, uncluttered and willing to do things far beyond what you gauge as their age. And I think you really have to kind of raise that bar with children. So the biggest lesson was a reminder of not underestimating.
That's great. To our next question, unless anyone else wants to chime in about working together. Okay. For our next question, this goes to you, Mr. Jenkins, from Diego from Discussing Film. He would like to know, what motivated your choice to lean into the use of metaphorical imagery, symbolism, and surrealist elements, such, of course, as the train, to a greater extent in this project?
Part of it came from, I think no matter what where we evolve to in our art, there's always something from our childhood that stays with us and that we're chasing. And I remember the first time I heard the phrase Underground Railroad, I imagined, I saw Black people on trains underground in a very grounded way. I just knew it was real, because as a child, you know, you grow up, no matter, and I grew up in a very hard way, but you just don't have those filters that, oh, this thing isn't possible, these people can't, or that thing didn't. It's just none of it. And so I heard it and I thought, oh yeah, of course we built trains underground. And so when I first read Colson's book, I got this feeling again. And even in the book, there's no trains levitating. The trains aren't flying in the sky. It's just that Black folks built them underground. And I thought, oh, this is kind of dope. And so right away, I wanted to lean into this feeling, this uncorrupted feeling, I like to describe it, that I had as a child. And as we went through the process of making the show, the symbolism that the question refers to, the surrealism, all those things came out of these very grounded symbols. I remember my grandma used to keep a penny and a jar under her bed. You know, it was these rituals that are passed down. And if those rituals can inspire a real belief, they have power. And I thought, oh, how can we, in telling Core story, how can we do this journey, take some of these other things, these very grounded things that our ancestors had, you know, from the detritus, you know, the harsh life they were living, and they repossessed those things and gave them a new meaning. It felt like an opportunity to do that. on the scale of the story that Colson Whitehead gifted to me. So it came part and parcel with the piece.
What was it like seeing those trains and stepping into that imagination? What was the most moving moment for you on this set?
Yeah, the biggest thing for me, because we started with that, and so, and it's funny, everyone here except Sheila, I think, maybe came through the train sets. She showed up just after we had wrapped the South Carolina episode. But it was like the first things we did were all the trains and the tunnels. And I told Mark Freeberg, our production designer, because again, I'm working from this childhood memory, this can't be fake. I want real tracks, real trains, real tunnels. I don't want blue screen, I don't want CGI. And so we found a private rail network and we built our tunnels above them. And so much of this project was trying to contextualize what it would have been like to be my ancestors, which is a very difficult thing to do, just because some of this history has been lost in the historical record. I think that's why we're creating these images and our own image now. But I remember when Tuso first comes down off the tracks, I said to her, and she must thought I was crazy, I was like, I think you need to get on the ground and you have to touch it. And not only do you have to touch it, you have to like bang on it, just because this is like if aliens came down, walked on your front door, and handed you a pepperoni pizza. You know, that's how strange this would be. And when we did it, because it was early in the shoot, I just remember just seeing her get down on her knees and bang on this actual track. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of what it felt like as a kid. This is what I wanted to do. And so I think I had to be my own sort of compass of what the surrealist, what this would feel like. But every time we did it, man, you know, through the power of camera and art department and these wonderful souls on the Zoom with me, I was like, oh yeah, that's kind of what I think it felt like.
For the rest of you all here too, seeing those trains, stepping onto these sets, stepping onto as real as the production team made this series, what are a couple of the moments that really stick out to you? Tuso, I saw you on mute, so I'll go to you first.
Well, I think for me, like one of the memories that I actually do have was like the first couple of days on set, if not the very first day, where everything was bigger than anything I could have imagined. That at some point, you know, you're supposed to report to the PAs if you go anywhere, you know, they need to know where you are. But at some point, I actually like snuck away just to step back and take in everything that I was seeing unfold before me. I even took a picture of it, of the, you know, from the outside, the tunnels over the train tracks, because I couldn't believe everything that I was seeing, you know. I felt like I was in the presence of brilliance, you know, everyone in the crew, everyone in the cast. It was amazing to take in, and then seeing the different types of trains, you know, that Cora rides in from, you know, Georgia, it's like this rickety boxcar barely holding it together, to then Indiana later on when it's this big, grand, majestic thing. It was a journey in itself, just, yeah, the experience.
Going to Sheila, please go ahead.
Yeah.
Yes.
Time, yeah. I was just gonna say, for me, I didn't get on the train, as Barry said, or get to see that stuff. But I was on the plantation sets, and one of the things that really sticks in my mind is, you know, I had to hold a fake placenta, and it felt so. I mean, it was really hard to hold because it was so, you know, difficult and slippery, but. I think those little attentions to detail, you know, were everywhere throughout the set, whether it was the huts that we were in or the cotton fields. And again, you know, in the interest of everyone's well-being and looking after everyone, I remember Barry saying lots of times, everyone, it looks very real. Everything looks very real. So when you get on set, just be aware that you are in a position where this could bring up some stuff for you. But yeah, I remember that placenta, and it came into my mind recently because, you know, there's a sequence where Mabel buries the placenta in the garden, and that's, you know, part of the ritual and an act of rebellion as well, because that is something that she would have brought with her from Africa. And, you know, I'm not West African and I'm not African American, I'm East African, but I recently learned that that's also something that they used to do in northern Uganda, where I'm from. And so that moment just really kind of flew back to me in this really kind of incredible moment of connection. So yeah, that really sticks in my mind.
And also, Sheila, apologies to you, because I think that was your very first scene. I'm almost positive.
Yeah.
That was your very first scene. Oh, man.
Yeah, and I remember for, like, most of the beginning of the shoot, I was just covered in blood.
Right.
Like, every day, I was like,
hey, welcome to Georgia. Welcome to Georgia.
Well, to our next question, which is for Aaron. Aaron, you and Tuso, you guys are brilliantly, this is from Gabe, you guys are absolutely devastating and act these roles brilliantly with layers of humanity. How was it forming your character's relationship?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I think first of all, I want to thank Barry for bringing Tuso and I together for rehearsals, because that was the foundation and the base of our friendship and our working relationship. So, you know, we would rehearse and we would explore different options of exploring the narrative and the text. And from those rehearsals, Tuso and I, we just developed our own friendship by sharing just our genuine interests as individuals and our genuine thoughts and feelings about the subjects that we were going to be managing and dealing with. And I think, having now watched the series myself, I think sometimes you can only reflect on these things when you see it. But I can see our connection as friends portray itself on screen. And I think the specific element that portrays itself is the trust that we developed. And the trust that we developed was really key in order to allow ourselves to feel supported enough to explore those emotions and spiritual and physical spaces that were required to tell this story as truthfully and authentically as we could.
For William, next, kind of a similar vein, but this is from Jamie Steinberg of Starry Constellation Magazine. We loved you on The Good Place, which was a wonderful comedy, but did you make a conscious decision to pursue more dramatic roles, or was the Underground Railroad too good a project to pass?
Well, I mean, the first thing, I just want to dispel any myth that I'm out here choosing things. I'm going to, I'm taking down any opportunity that I can to work on stuff that's really interesting. And I put myself out there and hopefully I get invited to play. But there is none of this whole, like, this is what I will do next. That is not the way this works. I was really just excited to, I mean, like, honestly, I auditioned for this, and it was something that I didn't feel like this was going to be something that I was going to get. I was just like, well, you know, like, this is a really cool opportunity. These sides are really good. I want to play with them, and this may be the only chance that I get to do this, and so I'm going to enjoy doing that. And, to be able to actually play with this character and to come to work with these people every day, that was a bonus. That was beyond the realm of possibility as far as I was concerned. And so, I just felt really lucky that I got to be here at all. I still can't believe that I got to be a part of something that I, with so many people that I respect so highly. And, you know, after watching this series, I'm like, yo, I get to be around some giants. And, I just feel lucky to have been selected, but there was no choosing on my part. That was just me like being like, please, can I play too? I'd love to try.
Well, we are happy that you were chosen. And this cast is truly incredible, and plays to the idea of being able to translate this potentially more easily from book to screen. But the next question comes from Malcolm Venable from Shondaland, asking, Mr. Jenkins, What were the challenges in translating Coulson's amazing writing and the internal thoughts of the characters to screen? And how did you go about bringing those internal feelings and thoughts to life?
The challenge was the internal thoughts, the interiority, but that's always a challenge when you're going from book to screen, you know, unless you're bringing a lot of the book over in voiceover, and then that has its challenges unto itself. You know, I didn't want interior voice in this show for a few different reasons, but I think it's all casting, man. You know, it's all casting. It's all casting, and I think then, because we can see things, when you read a book, you can't see anything. Because we can see things, I thought, oh, there's interiority in the things the characters are choosing to take with them. There's interiority in the way the characters are choosing to present themselves, choosing to literally carry themselves. And so once, and again, this was a long process. We optioned this book before Moonlight finished award season, and then we made a whole film in between and released it. So it was a long gestation process. And so I kind of had it in my head of where the adaptation was going to really flourish in this medium. And then as we were making it, it was just one of the things that was really cool about doing this. It's 116 days. I've only ever done 34 days. After about that, you know, 24th day, you know, the cast and crew was just cooking. Now, for Cora, or for Tuso and Joel, that was great because they're there the whole time. Everyone else had to come in, you know, at these intervals and just kind of like slip in to Tuso's wavelength. But what was really great was watching the actors create story, generate story with their performance, and then being able to go and go, okay, cool. I thought I adapted the book into these scripts and built all these sets, and now the actors are adapting my adaptation to the thing that's actually real. They're actualizing it. And that was when everything just like, I mean, so much shit just opened up. There are so many things in the show that I can't personally take credit for. And I only mentioned one because we were talking about symbols. The okra seeds. You know, Matt Marks, my prop master who worked with me on Beale Street, walked into my office in Savannah one day and said, this is a pod of okra, Barry. I go, all right, cool. Why you sure be a pod of okra? I knew we had to build Mabel's plot and figure out what's actually going in it. Like Sheila said, so many details. And he shows me this okra pod. And he goes, I go, it looks dead. He goes, it is. You know, we've been in drought for 6 months. But don't worry, when we film, we'll have it all healthy. He goes, but I wanted to show you this. And he wrung it out over my desk. And all these seeds just landed on my desk. And it made it sound. And he picked one up and he put it right in front of me. And he said, no matter how dry this gets, if you plant it, it will grow. And if you've seen the show, you know exactly what happened. Just from the prop master walking into my office and showing me this thing, I think that's where the adaptation really came alive and where everyone from these beautiful people on here to the prop master being like, I want to contribute. I think this is something very interesting. This is how we take this from page to screen. So yeah, it was cool. You know, for me, the most satisfying creative experience of my life.
And of course, too, when you talk about the small details and the little contributions, your background performers are all also incredible. It's just this just amazing group effort. Joel, there is a question here for you from Gil Pringle from Film Inc. Australia asking, how did you enjoy working with your friend Damon Harriman, albeit only for a small scene? And how, as an Australian man, did you relate to this story?
Damon Harriman is one of the most constantly working, always brilliant. You know those actors that whenever you see them, you go, that guy's never not good, and in fact, is always brilliant. And I've known him since I was 19 years old, which was more than half my life ago. And yet we've had a lot of time together, but we've never really worked together significantly. And Barry made that happen. And I'm very happy to have done it. And
you push for it though. You got to tell the truth, man. So if you know Joel Edgerton, he is riding for you. Joel pushed. He's like, bro, David, you got to let David, you got to let David, you got to find something for David. And so David actually auditioned for this other part that would have been much more typical for him. And then I was like, yeah, Joel, he's all right. And he goes, no, bro, I'm telling you, just keep pushing him. And then we auditioned him for Martin, and he crushed it. There's a scene that's unfortunately not in the show that Damon did. It is beautiful. You know what I'm talking about, Tuso? When he comes back and he talks about his father, the one where y'all are sitting up in the attic. Oh, he has like this 4-minute monologue, but it's a TV show and I can't have no 4-minute monologues unless it's coming from that one right there. Or this one right here, Joel, just the damn 20-minute monologue. I need to cut you off, but Joel, he pushed for David Harriman to be in this show. And for all you Australians, I think all it was he wanted to get a couple beers with his homeboy. He's like, hey,
yeah, well, you know, I will say to that is a lot of, as a director, you know, like watching Barry handle this mammoth task for 116 days, spinning all those plates, and then at the early part of the process, all these actors are sending tapes through casting agents. And, you know, a lot of actors sort of don't get their time, and you know, and when you're confused and you're in the mire and you're watching all these tapes, maybe just the gold nugget flows down the river and you don't get to pick it up. So I think it's important as actors to support our friends and go, that guy's a gold nugget, and pick him up and have a look. And if he's not right, throw him back in the river. But he's a keeper.
True story. You rode for your homeboy, bro. I'm glad you did too, man. He's great.
Aussie.
We have a question here from Tuso. You're giving young Ruby Dee vibes throughout this series. Who are some of your acting inspirations? Some high praise.
My acting inspirations, definitely Viola Davis, you know, Angela Bassett, your Meryl Streeps, the veterans, who you see that there is a process that they go through in preparation, but when they get to set, they throw it away and dive in 100%. Yeah, that's me. Those are my inspirations.
Can I ask Sheila the same question? Just because I don't know how she did what she did. I mean, if you've seen the show, Sheila had maybe 5 days of shooting in the middle of all the other shooting that we were doing. And so there's no warm-up for her. So who are your acting inspirations? So Sheila and Aaron are in the show because I went to London after we finished Beale Street to see Andre Holland, and they were in Othello with Andre and Mark Rylands. And that's how these two folks ended up in my orbit. But I don't know shit about y'all, man. At least when I cast y'all, and you came in and both y'all just did the damn thing. So Sheila, who are your acting inspirations, and how did you prepare? I'm sorry, I'm taking over the junket now.
No, I wanted to hear that story.
But how did you prepare when you, because you just showed up, you had to do it. You know, everybody else had a little bit of lead time.
Yeah, that was it, really. Showed up and did it. No, but I think, so I'll do that, the inspirations first. Because what happened there is you asked me like 3 questions.
I did, so I know, I'm sorry, man. The coffee finally hit, I'm up now.
Very similar to Tuso, but to add to those, I want to add Sophie Okonedo, a British actress who I've never worked with, but I've seen so much of her work. And she's an incredible actor, but particularly in the theatre. And the other person I want to mention is a woman called Shirley Henderson, who played my mother in the show Girl from the North Country on stage, which was a Bob Dylan musical in London. And both of those actresses are so committed. They give like 150% every time you're looking at them. They're never laying up. And I just, yeah, I'm completely in awe of the things that they're able to achieve. And I guess, you know, leading on from that to talking about how I prepared, I like to keep my preparation processes very lean for any project. I don't like to load too much onto myself because I just want to be able to relax, you know, and I feel like the relaxation is actually the thing that allows whatever needs to come through to come through. So I make sure that I understand what's going on. I understand the characters. I've read the book, the source material. You know, I read a bit about midwifery as well to understand what it was like to be a midwife in that particular circumstance. And then the rest was just, you know, it was in the text. And I think speaking about those two actresses in particular and the way in which they throw themselves in and immerse themselves and just take risks, I think that was the only way I could really, you know, jump into a project like that. It's just a kind of sink or swim situation. But also I had such great admiration for everyone. And also I was, you know, particularly in my thread, I was working with some actors, you know, Abigail, for example, who plays Polly, the first screen job, you know, and they were just also like coming in and going, oh my God, I'm in this amazing production and I never thought I'd be in one. And here, you know, so I think for everyone, there was a sort of dream come trueness about it, but also this feeling of just really wanting to do right by the project and really wanting to make sure that I was, you know, up to the challenge of meeting all of my peers and everyone on this project at the same level, because everyone, as you said, from top to bottom, left to right, was bringing their A game and beyond. And so there wasn't really time for me to worry about myself in that way. I just had to trust that I was, you know, you asked me to be in it, so I was like, okay.
And I'm glad you did, because, you know, it was trust both ways. I think at the moment we cast you, we didn't even have a script for that episode. Because it was hard to find it. It was hard. That one was hard. Yeah. That one was hard. Yeah,
I think you did a sort of amazing job of taking it from the book and kind of imbuing that chapter that's in the book with all of the details that allow the piece, I think, to kind of have this, I don't know, this climactic moment where it feels like things go full circle and it feels like we sort of get closure through the paradox of also Cora not having that closure, but we as the audience get it for her.
It's so hard, man.
I had to be trust. I was like, they were like, so there's this barrier. I was like, yep. And I was like, why are they asking me just say yes on my behalf? Why are you asking me questions? Just yes, fine, just so, you know.
You know, it's funny because I've seen the others on here more than I've seen Sheila since we wrapped. And I'm just having these memories of, because we shot, it was South Carolina, Georgia, then Mabel. And then we did that one day in the really big cotton field. And I remember leaving Savannah with you. I said goodbye to you and Abby. And then that Monday, we went to this big cotton field. Y'all remember that big group shot that we did in the field, Tuso and Aaron? I think the only reason we did that, because it wasn't planned, was kind of that feeling that we got from making the Mabel episode. There was just something about, like, I don't know, something just felt very whole about where we left the plantation. And then ending in the cotton field, I was like, you know what? I think we need to see everybody. I think we need to see everybody, and everybody needs to be looking. And there's no flinching, you know? But we will not flinch. Anyway, I'm sorry, Angelique. I'm just going to say this now.
Thank you all, because the unflinching actually leads me to the very last question, because we got to let y'all go get in your junket rooms. You guys have more to dissect, because we could really talk about the series for 10 hours, the length of the series itself. But Barry, for how unflinching this series is in its portrayal of slavery in the antebellum South, you know, do you feel more or less convinced that the audience is ready to see this story right now, knowing how hard you had to go?
I think I wouldn't have made it if I didn't feel like the audience was ready for it. I think even the way we made it, you know, the signpost for me was to be very forthright about the truth we were telling. And also to have a very strong ethical and moral compass. It's why Miss White, Miss Kim, was on set with us. You know, I feel like we were watching each other, she was watching us, and then I think, you know, because of where we were filming, the ancestors were as well. As I said before, you know, there's a reason it isn't a feature film. You know, I didn't want to force the audience into a captive experience. You know, if you want to pause, play, boom, 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 you can do whatever. I will say only 1.5 of these episodes take place on a plantation. The other 8.5 hours, the remaining balance of it, is about this woman on this journey, like I said, to reconcile the abandonment she feels from her mother. And so, yeah, I do think the audience is ready for it. And if they aren't, I think that's fine too. You know, I think the thing that's really beautiful about putting images into the world is that when someone's ready to find that image, it will be there. And I think what we all did in creating this show, I think it honored our ancestors. I think we were respectful of ourselves, respectful of the text, and respectful of the audience. So I do think folks are ready. I wouldn't have made it if I didn't think they were.
Well, thank you all for putting that art there and putting all of your all into it. Thank you to the audience for joining us for this press conference conversation. And please be sure to remind everyone that you know that the Underground Railroad is going to be exclusively available on Amazon Prime Video beginning on May 14th. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you, Angelique.
Thank you.
Thanks, Angelique.